Buddhist Summer School, Monday afternoon, 5th September 1983. You may remember that yesterday, towards the end of our meeting, we were considering the significance of the use of the word infinity by the Buddha when he talks of the infinity of akasha and the infinity of vijnana as representing the first two samapattis into which the one who meditates enters. And I think I ended up by quoting the Buddha's words from the Udana: "Hard is the infinite to see. Truth is no easy thing to see." Now, this consciousness functioning transcendentally marks, so to say, the entry, the beginning of a higher, a profounder octave of consciousness than that compassed by vijnana, which is discriminative consciousness. It is the analytical consciousness, the divider, the separator, the distinguisher. Now we are entering into the state of the unity consciousness. The transcendent context wholly subsumes and completely interpenetrates the finite and mortal context. Now this is something which very few ever see. We talk of the transcendent as a world or a state beyond, something other than this. It is other than this only in the sense that it is of a quality which defies all description and an intensity which cannot be measured. But otherwise, the transcendent completely interpenetrates this ordinary world. And I have talked in terms of the context of the infinite, the eternal, the immortal. And it interpenetrates it in an extraordinary way. It's not as if it interpenetrates the whole cosmos that we can observe and experience and so forth. But every single thing or person, every single atom is permeated by the whole of infinity and eternity. Now, of course, it's impossible for the brain to picture this. That is why it is so difficult. But if you can keep the words in mind, and in the quiet, with the body and psyche peaceful, just let the words convey their message, if it is possible, and you'll thrill to a sense of transcendence at what it implies. So, the perfected Holy One can function freely in either context as and when required by him. There is an outstanding difference between the Holy One's functioning in the mortal context and our functioning in the worldly sphere. I assume there are no Buddhas here, present here. If there are, I trust they will correct me if I'm misleading you. But if I'm not misleading you, perhaps they will be good enough to corroborate me. The difference is this: nothing in the finite mortal sphere can delude the Holy One. You remember how often the Buddha says that the perfected one cannot be deluded. He is no longer liable to delusion. I, the ordinary mortal, can be deluded. That's the difference. And yesterday I mentioned that in ancient Bactria, Zarathustra taught the Dhamma, and of course his language was Avastan. And the word for the Dhamma in Avastana is Asha. And in the Rig Veda, it is Ritta. Now, it is quite remarkable that in the Zarathustrian Gathas and in the Rig Veda, we have a very interesting statement. In the Gathas, the holy immortals, as they are called, are lords of Asha. Lords of Asha. The Rig Vedic gods are declared to be sons of Ritta. The Arahats, the true Brahmins, are Dhamma become, born of the mouth of the Tathagata. You'll find that in the Iti Uttaka. He says so himself. They are called winners of the deathless. Now, accepting Buddhism and pre-Buddhistic Brahmanism, that is the Upanishadic teaching, all the great living religions of today are theistic. All of them have ascribed power to God or to whoever they regarded as the creative and controlling source of the universe, and adorned him with human qualities in superlative degree. To this day, God is pictured as a black Superman for many black people, and is pictured as a white Christian supreme being by many white people. This is natural, for human beings have a tendency to read themselves into the transcendent by a sort of inductive imagination. The Brahman of the Vedic Upanishadic holy ones has both personal and impersonal elements. But very significant and original is the affirmation of the identity of Brahman and Atma. Now, the populace believes that Hindu populace believes that each person has an Atma, his own Atma, just as theists will talk of their immortal spirit or their spark of divinity. Now, this is quite a mistaken notion. You cannot have your particular immortal spark, your particular little Atma. The Atma is presented as infinite, as eternal, as all-pervading. It's a one only. Can you carve out a slab of space and screw your nameplate on it? In precisely the same way, you cannot have your particular, you cannot be the owner of your particular bit of Atma. There's no such thing. The transcendent is all-pervading, completely through and through everything as such. And no one can claim the eternal or the infinite as his own special eternal or infinite, as if it were an entity. Because if you think of it as an entity, you have to acknowledge that the entity comes into being, proceeds, and dies. So to talk of God as an immortal personal being, or to talk of your Atma or anything as your particular Atma, is a mistaken way of talking altogether. This must be remembered. And when the Upanishadic teachers taught that the Atma and Brahman are identical, you must think of the Atma as exactly the same as Brahman. Why two words in that case? Brahman is an objective term. Atma is a subjective term. inquiring what is ultimate reality, they came to the word Brahman. What am I? They arrived at the word Atma. And they discovered that this I is not just the particular property of the psychophysical organism, which is a mortal, perishable thing. It's a marvelous story of how these holy ones arrived at these things. Now, I think I'll read you a little bit from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. A Brahman, himself a teacher, called Uddalaka Aruni, said to Yajnavalkya. Yajnavalkya was called Yogeshwara, usually translated as Prince of Yogis, but Yoga and Ishwara. Ishwara is the creator god, actually. So they exalted him to the position of a creator god when they said Yajnavalkya is a Yogeshwara. And Uddalaka poses some questions to him. And he ends up by saying, he asks Yajnavalkya, declare the inner controller. And Yajnavalkya answers, he who, dwelling in the earth, yet is other than the earth, whom the earth does not know, whose body the earth is, who controls the earth from within, he is your Atma, the inner controller, the immortal. And he goes on like that. And in connection with the individual being as such, he says, he who, dwelling in breath, one's own breath, yet is other than breath, he is your soul, the inner controller, immortal. And he completes that exposition by saying, he is the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the ununderstood understander. Other than he, there is no seer, no hearer, no thinker, no understander. He is your Atma, the inner controller, the immortal. Then Uddalaka sits down. He has asked his question and received his answer. He's quite satisfied. Then there rises up a woman, perhaps one of the foremost doctors of philosophy of the age, called Gargi. She was the daughter of a Brahman, Vachaknu. And she asks certain questions about what underlies all the whole of the cosmos. And Yajnavalkya answers, Akasha. And Gargi says, adoration to you, Yajnavalkya, in that you have solved this question for me. And then she asks, across what then, pray, is Akasha woven, warp and woof? And Yajnavalkya answers, that, O Gargi, Brahmins call the imperishable. It is not coarse, not fine, not short, not long, not glowing, not adhesive, without shadow, darkness, without air, without space, stickiness, and so on, right to the end. He mentions so many things, it's rather long. And he ends up by saying, it consumes nothing so ever. Nothing so ever consumes it. If we can meditate on those two lines and successfully reach the culmination of that meditation, we would be very much enlightened. It's an extraordinary statement about the Atma, about Brahman. It consumes nothing so ever. Nothing so ever consumes it. It's a magnificent statement of the transcendent. And then he says this at the very end. Verily, O Gargi, that imperishable is the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, etc., as before when he answered Uddalaka. Now, that is the presentation in impersonal terms. But the Upanishads also presented a personal God. And this comes out best, I think, in the Svetashvatara Upanishad. I've got here Mascaro's translation. Mascaro is a real poet, a mystic, and a real devotee. He's a Spaniard by birth, Catholic by birth, but a master of Pali, Sanskrit, and of the Buddhist and Upanishadic teachings. The real master. And this is from the Svetashvatara. In chapter 3, there is one in whose hands is the net of Maya, who rules with his power, who rules all the worlds with his power. He is the same at the time of creation and at the time of dissolution. Those who know him attain immortality. God is in truth the whole universe, what was, what is, and what beyond shall ever be. He is the God of life immortal, and of all life that lives by sustenance. The light of consciousness comes to him through infinite powers of perception, and yet he is above these powers. He is God, the ruler of all, the infinite refuge of all. I know that spirit whose infinity is in all, who is ever one beyond time. I know the spirit whom the lovers of Brahman call eternal, beyond the birth and rebirth of life. The Buddha's remarkably original and efficient affirmation of transcendence integrates both personal and impersonal elements, thus standing free of the limitations inevitably imposed by any personal or impersonal statement. Now here from the Udana. Because there exists that condition, this is the impersonal statement, because there exists that condition wherein is neither earth nor water nor fire nor air, wherein is neither the sphere of infinite space nor of infinite consciousness, nor of nothingness, nor of neither consciousness nor unconsciousness. Where there is neither this world, nor a world beyond, nor both together, nor moon and sun. Thence, because, I declare, is no coming to birth, thither is no going from life, therein is no duration, thence is no falling, there is no arising. It is not something fixed, it moves not on, it is not based on anything. That indeed is the end of ill. And he goes on to say, hard is the infinite to see, truth is no easy thing to see. Craving is pierced by him who knows, for him who seeth, naught remains. Naught meaning the complete absence of all raga, dosa, moha, greed, hate, delusion. And then he goes on to say, monks, there is a not born and not become, etc. You all know that very well, so I need not repeat it. So that is the Buddha's statement. Now, the negation of any transcendent, identifiable, permanent entity as constituting or residing in the whole or any part of the existential being, that is from rupa to vijnana, the nama rupa in short, is presented in the anatta doctrine. The Buddha's affirmations in personal terms are most interesting. You know how when he is going towards Gaya from the tree of enlightenment on his way to Isipatana in Benares, he meets with Upaka, an ascetic who says to him, your reverence, your sense organs are quite pure, your complexion very bright, very clear. On account of whom have you, your reverence, gone forth, or who is your teacher, or whose Dhamma do you profess? Now here comes a tremendous personal statement of the transcendent itself. Victorious over all, omniscient am I, among all things undefiled, leaving all through death of craving freed, by knowing for myself whom should I follow. For me there is no teacher, one like me does not exist. In the world with its devas no one equals me, for I am perfected in the world, the teacher supreme am I. I alone am all awakened, become cool am I, nirvana attained. Then Upaka says, according to what you claim, your reverence, you ought to be the victor of the unending. Like me, the Buddha answers, they are victors indeed who have won to destruction of the cankers. Vanquished by me are evil things, therefore am I, Upaka, a victor. That is his personal affirmation, because he had realized complete unity with what we call transcendence itself. Then there is another statement. It comes in the Vinaya, volume 1, when he meets a Brahman of Vairanjya. He says, O Brahman, having pierced through the shell of ignorance for the sake of creatures going in ignorance, I am unique in the world, utterly enlightened with unsurpassed enlightenment. I myself, Brahman, am the world's eldest and highest. And the commentary to the Vinaya Pitaka explains, eldest on account of being the first born among the Ariyas, the noble ones. The Ariyas are defined as Buddhas, Paccheka Buddhas, and disciples of Buddhas, and highest because he is the supreme leader now and teacher. Now this may sound like boundless conceit, but note, in the Old Testament, what the Lord says to Moses, it comes in Leviticus chapters 19, 20 and 22. And remember, it is in Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18, that you get the commandment, love thy neighbor as thyself. That comes in Leviticus, first of all. Now, the Lord says so many things to Moses in so many verses, and ends up the verse by saying, I am the Lord. But what do we mean by the Lord saying these things to Moses? Moses himself, in the supreme meditative state, in unity with transcendence, experiences something which he interprets when he comes back to ordinary sense, brain, consciousness and activity. He interprets it in that way. All these statements are made by a living person, by the mortal psychophysical organism. And the authority is such a powerful spiritual authority that it is put in that form. I am the Lord. He ends up. Now, who is the Lord? When you are in the supreme meditative state, in perfect unitary consciousness, you yourself are the supreme being. What you say after returning from that state is God's word. Necessarily, it is a limited expression because a conditioned brain is formulating in finite and mortal terms that which was realized in transcendent consciousness. And all language suffers the unavoidable constraints of duality or multiplicity. In the Avastha, we have a very remarkable divine dialogue presentation in what is called the Ahura Mazda Yasht. You know that the Zarathustrian term for the Supreme Being is Ahura Mazda, meaning Lord of Life, Lord of Wisdom. Zarathustra asks Ahura Mazda, what are the most powerful means for defeating and overcoming evil? And Ahura Mazda answers, O Zarathustra, my names are the most powerful means for overcoming evil. And Zarathustra then asks, what are these names? And the very first, my first name, says Ahura Mazda, is Ahammi, I am. That is the most powerful name to dispel evil. So we see that the name is presented as a mantra, a word of power, which can purify and transform any ill state of the psyche as such. Now, in connection with this business of mantras, you know, there's a good deal in the modern world of banding mantras about and so on. And people just undergo a self-hypnotism about it all. And in the end, they are no different from what they were when they started. Thank goodness they are no worse. Now, in the Tarasara Upanishad. This is one of the so-called minor Upanishads. But don't get misled by the title of the book, Minor. Some of these minor Upanishads are far more important from the practical point of view than the so-called major Upanishads. Now, Bharadvaja asks Yajnavalkya, what is Taraka? What is that which causes one to cross the whole realm of ill? Yajnavalkya replied, Om Namo Narayanaya is the spell. It should be worshipped as Chidatma. And then he explains, Om is a single syllable and of the nature of Atma. Nama is of two syllables of the nature of matter, Prakruti. Narayanaya is of five syllables and is of the nature of Parabrahman. And then Yajnavalkya says, he who knows this becomes immortal. Now, if we just stop there, we will naturally wonder how on earth can you become immortal by muttering Om Namo Narayanaya. Of course you don't. But see what Yajnavalkya says. Through Om is Brahma produced, the first person of the Hindu Trinity. Through Na, Vishnu, through Ma, Rudra is produced. Through Na, Ishvara, through Ra, Anna Virat, through Ya, Purusha, through Na, the second Na, is Bhagwan produced, and through Ya is Paramatma produced. Now the point is this. These people were trained to meditate and enter very profound states. And these states were associated with various sounds, various syllables. It is no use just muttering the syllable or the series of syllables and expecting results to come. You have to enter into that state of meditation, as the Buddha would have put it, through the various jhanas, and your state of consciousness is such that it is the representative here and now in you, the psychophysical organism, of that which is a universal force, a universal energy. If you can do that, then the enunciation of the spell produces quite extraordinary results. I have myself seen in India in 1960 some extraordinary things in this way. Now, whereas in olden days it was so natural to think of the creative ruling power as a person, a transcendental superhuman, in our modern scientific age, it is possible to be free of anthropomorphism and understand the origin as primordial, undifferentiated, creative energy, self-replenishing and self-sustaining, potentially holding within itself the totality which ultimately emerges out of it through the constant creative action of this creative energy. Pure or absolute consciousness and mind as a formative power are some of its hidden potencies. We can give different names, and all those names will be true according to the way in which this creative energy manifests. But they are all identical in the ultimate. It is the one and only thing, that's all. We give names for our own convenience in trying to understand and communicate. Consciousness stirs energy to manifest itself and mind lays down the principles governing manifestation. This is the primordial lex eterna, the eternal law, the Dhamma. In St. Augustine's words, a law above our minds which is called truth. It was Dhamma or Ritta or Asha according to the land in which these teachings were given. It is the ultimate reality with which the Buddha identified himself. You remember the other day I said that the Buddha declares of himself to Vasettha that he is the Dhammakaya, the Brahmakaya, the Dhamma Bhuto, the Brahma Bhuto, the Dhamma body, the Brahma body. He himself is the Dhamma become. He is the incarnate eternal law controlling the totality. He himself. This Dhamma is inherent in every single thing and creature in this multitudinous cosmos. It is like a quiet, immortal seed hidden in everything existential, everything mortal. It is the duty of the existential to tend this seed in the manner appropriate to the special form of each existential, so that it comes to full fruition, and in our world, for instance, as the gem, the blade of grass, the flower and fruit, the tree, the insect, the reptile, the animal, the bird, the man, the angels and archangels, the devas and the great gods. Through each and every existential, the absolute consciousness thrills, broods lovingly over the form, and the pure mind inspires it. Remember, pure mind is not vijnana. Try and feel this with your body and psyche quiet. Better still, let light arise, and with enlightened vision, enjoy the ineffable bliss of truth. Sambhogakaya. It was said a little earlier that Origin may be understood as primordial, undifferentiated creative energy. This origin is the void plenum, the unborn, unbecome, unmade, uncompounded. Pure mind is the architect of creation. Absolute consciousness is the root of that desire by whose impulsion the entire cosmos comes into being. You remember I mentioned this yesterday or day before, I forget when. In the emergent process, consciousness is increasingly put to sleep as materialization continues, reaching its densest point in solid matter. Thereafter, it begins to awaken, but the light is still in darkness, as material evolution gives rise to plants, animals, and the human species. We who are still at the subhuman stage have added an extra dimension or two of darkness to imprison the light of transcendent consciousness by our isolativeness and separativeness. We are self-centered in a demoniacal way, trying to constrict and draw the whole world to our separate selves. Hence the endless conflicts, material and psychological. We are trying to conquer nature. What unparalleled stupidity and devilishness. Instead of intelligently cooperating with nature and totally giving ourselves in loving and tireless service to transcendence, the void plenum, the unborn, unbecoming, use what term you like. Absolute consciousness is unitary. Pure mind and consciousness are transparent. There is no opacity, no shadow, only pure light. The arc of evolution upwards after the descent into matter involved the emergence of the human species out of animal ancestry. Our psychophysical organism is thus the heir of animal characteristics. Consider the brain's reptilian part. You know, the brain stem is first surrounded by that part which is our heritage from the reptilian stage. And that is associated with aggressiveness, fear, violence, etc. Then that is surrounded by the mammalian part, which is responsible for care and love and protectiveness for the young. And finally, there is the cortex. And this cortex is the part which is specifically human, human in the advanced, developed sense. It is where our spiritual growth starts. Perception and right understanding of the Dhamma and its perfect expression in daily life finally transmutes our vijnana, our analytical, separative, isolative consciousness, into pure consciousness, the enlightened state, naturally and spontaneously expressing Mahakaruna and Panya throughout the existential life of the perfected Holy One. I'd like to add a word about consciousness. Consciousness is that which is indefinable, more or less. We don't know what consciousness is. We know what it means to be conscious of. But in being conscious of, there is a duality. I, the subject, am conscious of that or that as the object. See, there is a duality. But consciousness in itself is this unitary creative energy associated with that, all that process which ends up with knowledge and development and enlightenment and so forth. Now, when you are really conscious of something, it inevitably and invariably, spontaneously and naturally expresses itself in your every thought and feeling, your word and your action. If you are truly conscious of love and are not in that deluded state of an idea of love or some fancy of love, if you are truly conscious of love, then throughout your whole existential life, your every thought and feeling, your every word and action will inevitably and naturally express that love. Now, that is what I mean when I use this term consciousness, particularly pure consciousness or absolute consciousness.